We're going to continue looking at the book of Exodus tonight. Last week, I started a lesson and decided that I decided earlier in the day that I wasn't going to do the whole thing so that I could take my time through it. And I haven't even made new PowerPoints. I did. I changed this PowerPoint a little bit. The first few slides have no animation so I can go through it quickly. I made no changes to the PowerPoint, so the handout is just the same handout from last week. At least one of you had a leftover from last week, and so that's fine. And I took out some of my notes for the second half of the sermon and just started writing again on another sheet of paper and kind of expanded those notes so that I can talk for another hour and a half today, maybe two and a half. We'll just kind of see. That's not going to be the case. We're just going to look at the story that happens in Exodus chapter 14 and talking about that deliverance from the Red Sea. But I want to open again by referencing Psalm 105 and Psalm 106. They're a really interesting pair of psalms. They are the end of book 4 in the book of Psalms. And book 4 opens up in the 90s with just some of the best psalms in the entire book of Psalms, talking about the kingship and the power and authority and rule of just the absolute greatest king that there is. And I mean, it's hard to make those psalms be about David. Sometimes when you're reading a psalm, oh, is this David or is this Christ? And when you're reading through the 90s, it's about God, absolutely, his power and his authority. And it comes in these two really long psalms. 105 and 106 are both really long, and they're not telling the exact same story. Psalm 105 really happens first, the story, and the story of Psalm 106 happens afterwards. But essentially, you could look at it as they're telling the same story of God being there and helping his people. And in Psalm 105, it's woohoo, look at how awesome God is. And in Psalm 106, it's boohoo, look at how terrible, how dumb, how foolish we are. Look at the mess that we are. And that's the way we're going to start off. Look at how big of a mess we are. In Psalm 106, the psalm opens with praise. Praise the Lord, O give thanks to the Lord, for he is good, for his steadfast love endures forever. Who can utter the mighty deeds of the Lord or declare his praise? Blessed are they who observe justice, who do righteousness at all times. Remember me, O Lord, when you show favor to your people. Help me when you save them, that I may look upon the prosperity of your chosen ones, that I may rejoice in the gladness of your nation, that I may glory with your inheritance. Both we and our fathers have sinned. We've committed iniquity. We've done wickedness. Our fathers, when they were in Egypt, did not consider your wondrous works. They did not remember the abundance of your steadfast love, but rebelled by the sea at the Red Sea. And that's how the psalm begins. Take out verses 1 through 5, the great lauding and that's the introduction. The psalm really begins with verse 6. Both we and our fathers have sinned. That's what this psalm is about. And it begins with, well, when did they rebel and when did they leave the Lord? My stars, it doesn't take long, does it? Verse 7, when they were in Egypt, they didn't consider your works. They did not remember the abundance of your steadfast love, but rebelled by the sea, the Red Sea. And last week we talked about the 10th plague, which was the death of the firstborn. But we spoke mostly about in chapters 12 and really in chapter 13, the sacrifices for the firstborn and the redemption of the firstborn and how because of the great terrible work that God did in that last plague which was death for the Egyptians, that was also deliverance for God's people, and how the one plague was both death and deliverance. It was terrible in all directions. that everyone left that moment knowing that God owns all of the things, everything is of God, and if I want anything, I need to redeem it back from God. And that's what that firstborn redemption sacrifice was teaching. And then we looked at how God was there in the cloud and the fire. He went before them, and he led the way, and he helped them to be able to see. And I think that there's a neat connection there with the way Jesus is described in Hebrews. But then there is this idea that leads into what we're talking about tonight, how God was also behind them. He moved behind them so that there would be this protection when Pharaoh and his army was going to come up and follow after them. And that's where we're going to pick up. But this idea here in Psalm 106, God, you are great. God, I need you. God, I need your help. When you are blessing your people, be a blessing to me, because both we and our fathers have sinned. And when did they sin? They managed to sin between the two sermons, which was supposed to be one sermon. So that's a week. I mean, maybe some of you managed to pull sin off in the last week. I know I've made my mistakes. Okay, so a week is a long time. But drop the fact that I should have been able to get this done in one evening, right? They managed to sin between parts one and two, right? And it's pretty sad. It's a sad state. And whenever I'm hoping to be looking at stories in the book of Exodus, and the point isn't to say, look at how stupid they are. The point is to say, look at what we do. Look at how easy for us it is to make these monumental mistakes so quickly and so repeatedly. And so we're going to pick up in Exodus chapter 14, which is right after the fire and the cloud description. The Bible doesn't give us much information about that at the very end of chapter 13, verses 21 and 22. And so the fire and the pillar is there. They have seen the plagues. They have endured the plagues, not physically, but they've been in the nation and they've seen how others have endured it. Maybe we could say it that way. They don't have firsthand knowledge of how painful it was, but they were there as those things were happening. They didn't suffer it, but they were near those sufferings. These people of God know the power of God, and they see him there floating on fire or as this monumental cloud all day and all night. And so they see God in that way. And then in chapter 14, verse 1, the Lord said to Moses, "Tell the people of Israel to turn back and encamp in front of Phi-Hahiroth, between Migdol and the sea, in front of Baal Zephon. You shall encamp facing it by the sea. For Pharaoh will say to the people of Israel, 'They are wandering in the land. The wilderness has shut them in.' And I will harden Pharaoh's heart, and he will pursue them. And I will get glory over Pharaoh and all his hosts. And the Egyptians shall know that I am the Lord." There is this moment where God tells his people to turn back. And there's a lot of things that could be going on here in the language, but just flat out, they're going in a certain way and God is changing their direction. They're not going to go back through the Philistines. We saw that in chapter 13. But even that idea of turning back, I wonder how many of the people thought we're turning in the wrong direction and what are we doing and this is not the right way to go. And they're going to go and they're going to face the sea, because when you're on vacation, that's what you do. But when you are escaping somebody, that's not what you do. You don't look at the sea. You don't face the sea. You face the road that you're going. But see, that's what God had given them. God was giving them, this is the path you're going to take. I don't know if they understood that yet. But the path was going to be through the sea, because God is going to get his glory. This is not a thing for the Israelites, necessarily. This is not some easier path. Oh, I've got a shortcut through the water. That could have been a miraculous way of doing things. Maybe when they go across the Jordan, when they're entering the Promised Land, he says, "I'll make it easy for you by parting the Jordan River." But this is not about making things easy for them. This is about getting glory for himself over Pharaoh. And we got to get that into our head sometimes. That sometimes it has nothing to do with me. Sometimes it has everything to do with God. The church is what proclaims the manifold wisdom of God, according to Ephesians chapter 3. It's not the church so that I can do things and so that you can have things, but for God's glory. And then verse 5, when the king of Egypt was told that the people had fled, the mind of Pharaoh and his servants was changed toward the people, and they said, "What is this we have done? We have let Israel go from serving us." So he made ready his chariot and took his army with him, and took 600 chosen chariots and all the other chariots of Egypt with officers all over them, of all of them. And the Lord hardened the heart of Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and he pursued the people of Israel while the people of Israel were going out defiantly. The Egyptians pursued them, all Pharaoh's horses and chariots and his horsemen and his army, and overtook them and encamped by the sea by Pi Haharoth in front of Baal Zephon. And so the Israelites are overtaken. And we know that doesn't mean that they were overcome and they were embattled and they were destroyed, but we've been looking at this war going on in Ukraine, and the moment that the mighty Russian nation crossed the borders, a lot of people said, Ukraine's lost. Like that was the impression, because Russia is so big and Ukraine is so little, the moment that they crossed the borders, there's this feeling of, it's over. And so the Egyptians have come and overtaken the Israelites. Not literally they've crossed over and they've beat all of them, but by merely being where they were, and with the Israelites facing some dumb sea, what are they doing? They have overcome the Israelites. That's this image that we have here. I love how Pharaoh is wondering, why did we let them go? It's like, dude, everyone died a few days ago. You didn't just let them go, right? I think that this is so interesting. I don't believe in fate, right? Because we all have these, but God said, Pharaoh's going to let my people go, and I'm going to harden his heart. And there are some things that God sets in motion, and who are we to get in God's way? We might find out that if we're trying to resist this, we are trying to resist God. And Pharaoh says, why did I let them go? As if Pharaoh had any hand in any of these sorts of things. And so Pharaoh, who is absolutely steeped and enslaved in sin, why did I let them go? Let me fight God some more. Let's go get those people back. I'm telling you, enslavement to sin knows no rock bottom. Sometimes we talk about the story of the prodigal son and how he hit rock bottom. There's no such thing as rock bottom. The moment we finally turn and look up and try to find the top and try to find the way out, we might notice that we've stopped going down, but it's never made of rock. We can always make life worse. Just because that prodigal son stopped doesn't mean that he had hit the bottom. People can get so much lower, and I think the Pharaoh here is a pretty good example of that. He could have just been lost and been a universal disgrace. But no, God's going to get his glory over him. And so now we're going to continue starting in verse 10. When Pharaoh drew near, the people of Israel lifted up their eyes, and behold, the Egyptians were marching after them, and they feared greatly. And the people of Israel cried out to the Lord and said to Moses, "Is it because there are no graves in Egypt that you have taken us away to die in the wilderness? What have you done to us in bringing us out of Egypt? Is not this what we said to you in Egypt? Leave us alone that we may serve the Egyptians. For it would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than to die in the wilderness." And Moses said to the people, "Fear not, stand firm and see the salvation of the Lord, which he will work for you today. For the Egyptians whom you see today, you shall never see again. The Lord will fight for you, and you have only to be silent." Honestly, verses 13 and 14 could be a sermon, right? I'm not really going to focus on what Moses says here very much. I'm going to focus on the losers, not on the winner. You guys can write your Moses sermon if you'd like. But I want to focus on this idea that when they saw this conflict coming, They saw the trouble. Now, conflict here, I don't mean literally that they're going to have to fight, but that's the image. They see that they're going to fight, they're going to be destroyed, they're going to be fought. When you see that conflict coming, because often we can see the conflict coming, right? We know, if I do this, this is going to be the result. I've got to do the right thing, and I don't want to do the right thing, because if I do the right thing, it's going to lead to this sort of conflict coming down the road, and I don't want to deal with that. I don't want to do the hard thing, because if I do the hard thing right now, I'm going to have to keep doing the hard thing, and it's going to be a hard life. I'd rather take it easy. I'd rather duck out of this. I'd rather skate by. And so when we see those conflicts, we want to despair, we want to complain, we want to duck aside. In Matthew 13, when we're talking about the parable of the sower, and he throws out the seed on that rocky soil that has no root in and of itself, and when tribulation and persecution arises on account of the word, immediately he falls away because he had no root. And here is a people who are without root. They were in the wilderness. Okay. Or they've been slaves for all these... Okay, we can come up with all these reasons and excuses. Not Moses. There were people in there. Joshua, he made it through all the wilderness and then led the people in. There were people there who had roots, who had connections to the things that were right. You didn't have to be rootless because of the circumstances that you find yourself in. You can have this sort of root. So they see themselves and they're in this wilderness and they think it's their death. And what I think is interesting, and I want to keep coming to this theme as we start looking through the book of Exodus, because wilderness is a theme that you might, I don't know if you know this, the wilderness shows up a lot in the book of Exodus. Spoiler alert. But the wilderness is not death. The wilderness is trial. Yeah, a lot of people die in the wilderness, but the wilderness is not death, it is trial. And if you don't survive the trial, you're going to die. But the wilderness is a trial. And they are there, and they are faced with this temptation, and it doesn't take them very long before they lose their minds. That's what it said back in Psalm 106, verse 7. Our fathers, when they were in Egypt, did not consider your wondrous works. They did not remember the abundance of your steadfast love, but rebelled. And we can start thinking of all the rebellions and how they wanted their... No, they rebelled before they got into the wilderness. I mean, technically, right? Don't we usually say that they're still doing the Exodus here? They haven't finished Exodus, and they're already rebelling in this small version of the wilderness because they have this conflict. I can sympathize with the fear. I can sympathize with the concern. I can say, well, it doesn't look like there's anywhere to go. I mean, I can understand these sorts of feelings that they're dealing with. When they looked at the sea, they probably had no hope in it. And that was it looks like that's the direction God faced them. Look this way, and they looked, and there was no hope. So they turn around, and what do they see? And they see death chasing after them. Well, don't turn around. We might not understand the hope that God has offered to us. We might not have a good perception on the way things are going to work out, but we need to not turn around. In John chapter 12, there's another, just a neat little example of people who just weren't willing to hold on and to stick it out. In John 12, there's this the lesson that Jesus talks about, and he talks about how he himself is going to be lifted up and this light, that it wouldn't be around them any longer. And then John gets into this discussion about how there was unbelief. The people were unable to believe him. They were unwilling to believe him. And there's a strife and conflict with the people because they couldn't believe him. And John references the book of Isaiah and about how that was going to take place. Of course, people wouldn't believe Jesus. And then we get verse 42. Nevertheless, many, even of the authorities, believed in him. But for fear of the Pharisees, they did not confess it, so that they could not be put out of the synagogue, for they loved the glory that comes from man more than the glory that comes from God. Belief is not everything, right? The acceptance that there is a God is a good start, but it doesn't get us there. And they believed God was floating above them on fire and as a cloud, and they knew that they had but they didn't have the root. It talks about how in Psalm 106, they didn't remember the wondrous works of the Lord. They needed to recite, God did plagues, he can do this. God took care of the Egyptians before, he can take care of the Egyptians again. I don't know exactly what the right answer for what they needed to be saying, but they needed to do that. And in verse 10, they cry out to God. Now, I love complaints in the Bible. I've been just looking at and enjoying complaints in the Bible a lot. Because as I started reading through the Psalms, half of them are just, oh my goodness, everything's wonderful. And then more than half of them is everything's awful. And I think it's really interesting that the Bible includes complicated, down, depressing, sometimes ugly statements and ugly ideas. And there's these people wrestling through it. And the Psalms are full of complaints. And it's hard to find a psalm where the commentator says, and by the way, this was a bad psalm. I mean, we don't have that. And so I've been impressed with the times that God shows somebody complaining and he doesn't give them a spanking for it. And what am I supposed to learn from that? And I read this complaint and I go, this one's awful. For all the times where I like to say that God says it's okay to complain or he gives us the space to do something like that, I read this complaint here that they speak into Moses in verses 11 and 12, and I go, why do I know this one's wrong? Let's read it again. Exodus 14, 11. Is it because there are no graves in Egypt that you have taken us away to die in the wilderness? What have you done to us in bringing us out of Egypt? Is not this what we said to you in Egypt? Leave us alone that we may serve the Egyptians. For it would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than to die in the wilderness. It's right to cry out to God. It's not always a sin to complain. Why am I so frustrated with this complaint? I think the idea is that so many times when you look at a complaint, God, why haven't you? Where are you? What's going on? So much of the time in the Psalms at least, it is saying, God, you are this, and you are this, and you are this, and I don't see you acting that way right now. God, you are a just God. I want your justice. God, you are a helpful God. Why aren't you helping? And so there's always these references to the qualities of God, and I'll put myself in it, my inability to see God in the things that I'm seeing around me. And that's the complaint. God, why aren't you being God like you are? And in this complaint, they're saying, God, I don't like anything that you have. I don't like your ideas. I told you I didn't want to come out here. I've got a better idea than you. Why did you do this? There's no appreciation for God. I think that that's one of the big differences that we have here in these Israelites. Didn't I tell you this? Are they saying that to Moses or are they saying that to God? And this is absolute disrespect of the Lord. It isn't calling on God for his help. This is charging God with death, which is pretty ironic. He's literally in the middle of saving them from the enslavement, which is death, and saying, we'd be better off serving the Egyptians than dying in the wilderness. Well, number one, they're not going to die. Well, actually, most of them are eventually going to die, but that's as the story progresses. God didn't bring them into the wilderness to die. God took them away from death. So why did they want that? Again, this is a theme I think that we're going to see a lot. But Satan offers us enslavement, and Satan offers us things that we know. And as human beings, we want the things that we know, even if it kills us. We are more comfortable in a known death than we are in trying something new, in going a place we haven't been before, in looking at a path that I don't understand and I don't know what it's going to be like. I would rather slowly rot than to try something new. And that's the nature of us so often. And I think that that's the nature that we see in these Israelites. They were unwilling and they were afraid. There's a great idea I borrowed from an author. The oldest and the strongest emotion of mankind is fear, and the oldest and strongest kind of fear is fear of the unknown, is what this author was saying. And he went on to write the most terrifying stories he could think of, trying to present what is, you know, what does a person do in the face of something that is unknown? And these people, they rejected God, who's up there and above them. They gave up their choice, they gave up their heart, they gave up their will, and were trying to hand it back to their slave owners rather than to give it to God who was taking them out. God is called us to this straight and narrow path, right? Matthew 7:14, for narrow is the gate and straitened the way that leads to life, and few be they that find it. Why'd God make it so hard so that no one can get their way into heaven? No, the way is complicated, and people don't want to do it. Maybe we don't want to do it sometimes. I don't always want to do good. It's exhausting. I need to do better, and I need to keep trying. And these people here, the moment they faced a difficulty, they started slacking and they started falling back. Well, let's read God's salvation. Moses said, all you got to do is be quiet. I think that statement in verse 14 is wonderful. Either it is, be silent and watch the Lord, or, you know, shut up. Don't say these things. And I don't know which attitude Moses had in that. Lately I've been leaning towards the second. Verse 15 now. I'm going to read the rest of the chapter. The Lord said to Moses, why do you cry to me? Tell the people of Israel to go forward. Lift up your staff and stretch out your hand over the sea and divide it, that the people of Israel may go through the sea on dry ground, and I will harden the hearts of the Egyptians so that they shall go in after them. And I will get glory over Pharaoh and all his hosts, his chariots and his horsemen. And the Egyptians shall know that I am the Lord when I have gotten glory over Pharaoh, his chariots, and his horsemen. Then the angel of God, who was going before the host of Israel, moved and went behind them, and the pillar of cloud moved from before them and stood behind them, coming between them, between the host of Egypt and the host of Israel. And there was a cloud in the darkness, and it lit up the night without one coming near the other all night. Then Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and the Lord drove the sea back by a strong east wind all night and made the sea dry land, and the waters were divided. And the people of Israel went into the midst of the sea on dry ground, the waters being a wall to the left of them and on their right, a wall to them on their right hand and on their left. The Egyptians pursued and went in after them into the midst of the sea, all Pharaoh's horses, his chariots, and his horsemen. And in the morning watch, the Lord in the pillar of the fire of the cloud looked down on the Egyptian forces and threw the Egyptian forces into a panic, clogging their chariot wheels so that they drove heavily. And the Egyptians said, let us flee from before Israel, for the Lord fights for them against the Egyptians. Then the Lord said to Moses, stretch out your hand over the sea, that the waters may come back upon the Egyptians, upon their chariots, and upon their horsemen. So Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and the sea returned to its normal course when the morning appeared. And the Egyptians fled into it. The Lord threw the Egyptians into the midst of the sea. The waters returned and covered the chariots and the horsemen, all of the hosts of Pharaoh that had followed them into the sea, not one of them remained. And the people of Israel walked on dry ground through the sea, the waters being a wall to them on their right hand and on their left. Thus the Lord saved Israel that day from the hand of the Egyptians. Then Israel saw the Egyptians dead on the seashore. Israel saw the great power that the Lord used against the Egyptians, so that the people feared the Lord, and they believed in the Lord and in his servant Moses. It's an amazing story. This is absolutely the raw power of God displayed. God's work is terrible. The one moment of terrible, awful, awesome power, again, just what we saw a chapter ago, is death and deliverance in the same move. Death and deliverance. What's I think is so interesting is as they're going through, for some people it's solid ground and safe walls, and for other people it's a muddy and confused and panic driven ground. If you compare the way it says it over and over again, verse 22, Israel went in the midst of the sea on dry ground, the waters being a wall. But then in verse 25, the clogging the chariot wheels so that they drove heavily. And then we see that contrast drawn out again. It's just repeated over and over again. In verse 28, the waters returned and covered the chariots and the horsemen, verse 29, but the people of Israel walked on dry ground through the sea, the waters being a wall to them on their right hand and on their left. That repetitive We already know that part, God. Why are you repeating it? He's hammering the point home. They had solid, dry ground and safe, solid walls around them. And for everyone else, it was muddy. It was panic. It was confusion. It was being overwhelmed. And Paul talks about how this is a baptism of the people, right? Baptism of the people in the cloud and in the sea. And just think about that. There are those who look at the waters of baptism and all they see is confusion and problems and panic and I don't want to submit to God. I don't want to do this. I'm not saying that the water's going to attack them. But they're looking at that with this panic mind rather than this, I'm going to submit to God and do what he asks of me. Now, the people were there before, right? They're looking at the waters and they're going, we're all going to die. But God, they submitted to God. And God gave them a path and gave them walls and gave them the protection that they needed. And the very thing that was their path and the very thing that was their protection was the very thing that destroyed all the others. And we think about the wisdom and the foolishness of God and man. And man looks at what God sets up, kind of like the Israelites did. This isn't going to work at all. This is foolishness. A God that gets murdered makes no sense at all. It's not a bad argument. But when you learn the story of Jesus who came down and allowed himself to be murdered, to be killed and hung on the cross on our behalf, and we understand the power behind that, if we let ourselves listen to God, there's a lot that we can learn. And so the Israelites, they make it through, and the Canaanites, they're not there yet. The Egyptians are following through, and in verse 25, they want to flee from before Israel, for the Lord fights for them. And they turn back. And I'm going to make a point about them turning back. If they didn't turn back and they kept going through, they'd still get drowned, right? But I'm going to draw out the point that they wanted to turn back and the Israelites kept going straight. God has given us a path. And you can't put your hand to the plow and think that you can turn back and try anything else. I don't like the way this is going. I'm going to try something else. We're only going to drown. We're only going to get lost. We're only going to fall back into the very thing that's been chasing us all these years. We're going to be overwhelmed by it. God has called us to follow through and to make it through. Our sister and brother, Randy and Christine, talk about people who are willing to follow through when things get complicated and tricky, right? You have done something in your life. I don't know what it is. I hope you know what it is. You have done something that was tricky and complicated because you saw clearly what God said was right, and you dealt with it, and you made it through. Maybe you've also not. We need to follow through. We need to hold on because God is going to give us solid ground to walk on. And the very thing that seems intimidating and seems like we can't make it through is our deliverance. Because once you say no to sin and say no to temptation and say no to that thing that is chasing after you, if you say that once, it's so easy to say it twice. And eventually, resist the devil and he shall flee. You don't have to say it about that very much because he's going to stop trying you. He'll invent something else. But he's going to stop because you have said no. I don't know, how many times does it take? Twice? Three times? That's what we have. God has given us this path. He's given us a way out of the slavery and the death. And just because it's a wilderness doesn't mean it's going to be death. But it is a wilderness, so it's going to be a little bit dry and a little bit hard, and it might stub your toe a little bit. But we can make it through. That's why I love looking at these Old Testament stories. It's just seeing these people who make like boneheaded mistakes, as well as wonderful examples of following after the faith that God gives them. They literally saw the power of God and the death of the Egyptians floating in the waters. I don't think I would want to see that. But they did see that. And they react with Exodus chapter 15. And we're going to close by looking at this. These are the Psalms that we'll close with. Exodus 15, where Moses has a song, and then Miriam has a song. These need to be our songs. I mean, I don't know if you want to change the words to be more appropriate to your day and your situation, or you can just kind of put in difficulties that you've seen God help you with and call that the rider, the horse and his rider. But God has tossed all of our problems away, and every new one that arises, he can do that as well. Exodus 15, verse 1. Then Moses and the people of Israel sang this song to the Lord, saying, I will sing to the Lord, for he has triumphed gloriously. The horse and his rider he has thrown into the sea. The Lord is my strength and my song, and he has become my salvation. This is my God, and I will praise him, my father's God, and I will exalt him. The Lord is a man of war. The Lord is his name. Pharaoh's chariots and his host he has cast to the sea, and his chosen officers were sunk in the Red Sea. The floods covered them. They went down into the depths like a stone. Your right hand, O Lord, glorious in power, your right hand, O Lord, shatters the enemy. In the greatness of your majesty, you overthrow your adversaries. You send out your fury. It consumes them like stubble. At the blast of your nostrils, the waters piled up. The floods stood up in a heap. The deeps congealed in the heart of the sea. The enemy said, I will pursue. I will overtake. I will divide the spoil. My heart, my desire shall have its fill of them. I will draw my sword. My hand shall destroy them. You blew with your wind, the sea covered them, they sank like lead in the mighty waters. Who is like you, O Lord, among the gods? Who is like you, majestic in holiness, awesome in glorious deeds, doing wonders? You stretched out your right hand, the earth swallowed them. You have led in your steadfast love the people whom you have redeemed. You have guided them by your strength to your holy abode. The peoples have heard, they tremble. Pangs have seized the inhabitants of Philistia. Now are the chiefs of Edom dismayed. Trembling seizes the leaders of Moab. All the inhabitants of Canaan have melted away. Terror and dread fall upon them because of the greatness of your arm, that they are as still as stone. Till your people, O Lord, pass by, till the people pass by whom you have purchased. You will bring them in and plant them on your own mountain. The place, O Lord, which you have made for your abode, the sanctuary, O Lord, which your hands have established, the Lord will reign forever and ever. For when the horses of Pharaoh with his chariots and his horsemen went into the sea, the Lord brought back the waters of the sea upon them, but the people of Israel walked on dry ground in the midst of the sea. Then Miriam the prophetess, the sister of Aaron, took a tambourine in her hand, and all the women went out after him with tambourines dancing, and Miriam sang to them, Sing to the Lord, for he has triumphed gloriously. The horse and his rider he has thrown into the sea. And I've never seen God triumph like that, but I've seen the triumph of God in my life. I've seen the changes that he's made in other people's lives. I've seen people who, they're good. They're well. They're taken care of. And so we need to remember that line, that the horse and his rider he has thrown into the sea. God is always for us. We might not understand the direction that he's faced us, and we might have a complaint, where are you, God? Let's learn how to do those the right way. And always have a heart open to listen to him. I don't know where you are on your journey right now. You might be hurting physically or emotionally. You might be wondering, where is God? And why is this happening? There's a lot of issues in this world right now. There's always been a lot of issues. And you need to cry out to God. I think it's right that the people did. I think they did a poor job at it, but they needed to cry out to God. They were willing to listen to Moses and do what Moses gave them to do. And that's what we need to do. When God gives us a direction, when Jesus tells us what to do, we need to submit to him. And we need to follow through. We need to We need to not turn back when we're halfway through the waters. We need to not turn back when we're right there on the edge of the sea thinking that slavery is better than anything that God has in front of us. We need to keep going forward no matter how confusing or how difficult it may seem. And there's a lot of sisters and brothers here who are happy for you and willing to pray for you if you need those sorts of things. Or if you need, maybe you need to go through the waters yourself and be baptized. If there's anyone here who needs that sort of help tonight, why don't you come forward as we stand and sing?